Santan must indeed have died a small death, because when she regained consciousness, she was aware of the morning light through her closed lids. The prospect of another day of torment and suffering made her clench her eyelids tightly and try to retreat again into black oblivion. Then she became aware of a small sound like the morning breeze in a pile of dry twigs, or the noise of an insect moving with clicking armored limbs over a rocky surface. The sound troubled her until she made the enormous effort required to roll her head towards it and open her eyes. A small humanoid gnome squatted 10 feet from where she lay, and she knew that she must be hallucinating. She blinked her eyes rapidly, and the congealed mucus that gummed her lids smeared across her eyeballs and blurred her vision. But she could just make out a second small figure squatting behind the first. She rubbed her eyes and tried to sit up, and her movements provoked a fresh outburst of the strange, soft crepitating and clicking sounds. But still, it took her a few seconds to realize that the two little gnomes were talking to each other in suppressed excitement, and that they were real, not merely the figments of her weakness and illness. The one nearest to Santan was a woman, for a pair of floppy dugs hung from her chest to well below her belly button. They looked like empty pigskin tobacco pouches. She was an old woman. No, Santan realized that old was not the word to describe her antiquity. She was as wrinkled as a sun-dried raisin. There was not an inch of her skin that did not hang in loose folds and tucks, that was not wrinkled and riven. The wrinkles were not aligned in one direction only, but crossed each other in deep patterns like stars or puckered rosettes. Her dangling breasts were wrinkled, as was her fat little belly, and baggy, wrinkled skin hung from her knees and elbows. In a dreamlike way, Santan was utterly enchanted. She had never seen another human being that vaguely resembled this one, not even in the travelling circus that had visited Mortom every summer before the war. She struggled up on one elbow and stared at her. The little old woman was an extraordinary colour. She seemed to glow like amber in the sunlight, and Santan thought of the polished bowl of her father's meerschaum pipe, which he had cured with such care. But this colour was even brighter than that, bright as a ripe apricot on the tree, and despite her weakness, a little smile flickered over Santan's lips. Instantly, the old woman who had been studying Santan with equal attention smiled back. The network of wrinkles constricted about her eyes, reducing them to slanted Chinese slits. Yet there was such a merry sparkle in those black shiny pupils that Santan wanted to reach out and embrace her, as she would have embraced Anna. The old woman's teeth were worn down almost to the gums and were stained tobacco brown, but there were no gaps in them, and they appeared even and strong.
"Who are you?"
Santan whispered through her dark, swollen, dry lips, and the woman clicked and hissed softly back at her. Under the loose, wrinkled skin, she had a small, finely shaped skull, and her face was sweetly heart-shaped. Her scalp was dotted with faded grey woolly hair that was twisted into small, tight kernels, each the size of a green pea, and there was bare scalp between them. She had small, pointed ears lying close to the skull like the pixies in Santan's nursery books, but there were no lobes to the ears, and the effect of sparkling eyes and pricked ears was to give her an alert, quizzical expression.
"Do you have water?" Santan whispered. "Water, please."
The old woman turned her head and spoke in that sibilant, clicking tongue to the figure behind her. He was almost her twin, the same impossibly wrinkled apricot-glowing skin, the same tight wisps of hair dotting the scalp, bright eyes and pointed lobeless ears. But he was male. This was more than evident, for the leather loincloth had pulled aside as he squatted, and a penis out of all proportion to his size hung free, the uncircumcised tip brushing the sand. It had the peculiar arrogance and half-erect tension of the member of a man in full prime. Santan found herself staring at it, and swiftly averted her eyes.
"Water," she repeated,
and this time Santan made the motion of drinking. Immediately, a spirited discussion flickered back and forth between the two little old people.
"Oh, this child is dying from lack of water,"
the old bushwoman told her husband of 30 years. She pronounced the first syllable of his name and the popping sound of a kiss.
"Gliswa." "She is already dead,"
the bushman replied quickly.
"It is too late, honey."
His wife's name began with a sharp, explosive aspirate and ended with a soft click made with the tongue against the back of the top teeth, the sound that in Western speech usually signifies mild annoyance.
"Water belongs to all, the living and the dying. That is the first law of the desert. You know it well, old grandfather."
Hani was being particularly persuasive, so she used the enormously respectful term old grandfather.
"Water belongs to all the people," he agreed, nodding and blinking. "But this one is not San. She's not a person. She belongs to the others."
With that short pronouncement, Owa had succinctly stated the bushman's view of himself in relation to the world about him. The bushman was the first man. His tribal memories went back beyond the veils of the ages to the time when his ancestors had been alone in the land. From the far northern lakes to the Dragon Mountains in the south, their hunting grounds had encompassed the entire continent. They were the aboriginals. They were the men. The San. The others were creatures apart. The first of those others had come down the corridors of migration from the north, huge black men driving their herds before them. Much later, the others with skins the colour of a fish's belly that redden in the sun and pale, blind-looking eyes had come out of the sea from the south. This female was one of those. They had grazed sheep and cattle on the ancient hunting grounds and slaughtered the game, which were the bushman's kine. With his own means of sustenance wiped out, the bushman had looked upon the domesticated herds that had replaced wild game on the veldt. He had no sense of property, no tradition of ownership, nor of private possession. He had taken of the herds of the others as he would have taken of wild game, and in so doing had given the owners deadly offence. Black and white, they had made war upon the bushman with pitiless ferocity, ferocity heightened by their dread of his tiny childlike arrows that were tipped with a venom that inflicted certain excruciating death. In impis, armed with double-edged stabbing assegais, and in mounted commandos carrying firearms, they had hunted down the bushmen as though they were noxious animals. They had shot them and stabbed them and sealed them in their caves and burned them alive. They had poisoned and tortured them, sparing only the youngest children from the massacre. These they chained in bunches, for those that did not pine and die of broken hearts could be tamed. They made gentle, loyal, and rather lovable little slaves. The bushman bands that survived this deliberate genocide retreated into the bad and waterless lands where they alone, with their marvellous knowledge and understanding of the land and its creatures, could survive.
"She is one of the others," Owa repeated, "and she is already dead. The water is only sufficient for our journey."
Hani had not taken her eyes off Santan's face, but she reproached herself silently.
"Old woman, it was not necessary to discuss the water. If you had given it without question, then you would not have been forced to endure this male foolishness." Now she turned and smiled at her husband. "Wise old grandfather, look at the child's eyes," she wheedled. "There is life there yet, and courage also. This one will not die until she empties her body of its last breath."
Deliberately, Hani unslung the rawhide carrying bag from her shoulder and ignored the little hissing sound of disapproval that her husband made.
"In the desert, the water belongs to everybody, the San and the others. There is no distinction, such as you have argued. From the bag, she took out an ostrich egg, an almost perfect orb, the colour of polished ivory. The shell had been lovingly engraved with a decorative circle of bird and animal silhouettes, and the end was stoppered with a wooden plug. The contents sloshed as Hani weighed the egg in her cupped hands, and Santan whimpered like a puppy denied the teat.
"You are a willful old woman," said Owa disgustedly.
It was the strongest protest that Bushman tradition allowed him. He could not command her. He could not forbid her. A Bushman can only advise another. He had no rights over his fellows. Amongst them there were no chiefs nor captains, and all were equal, man and woman, old and young. Carefully Hani unplugged the egg and shuffled closer to Santan. She put her arm around the back of Santan's neck to steady her and lifted the egg to her lips. Santan gulped greedily and choked, and water dribbled down her chin. This time Hani and Owa hissed with dismay. Each drop was precious as lifeblood. Hani withdrew the egg, and Santan sobbed and tried to reach for it.
"You are impolite,"
Hani admonished her. She lifted the egg to her own lips and filled her mouth until her cheeks bulged. Then she placed her hand under Santan's chin, bent forward, and covered Santan's mouth with her own lips. Carefully, she injected a few drops into Santan's mouth and waited while she swallowed before giving her more. When she had passed the last drop into Santan's mouth, she sat back and watched her until she deemed that she was ready for more. Then she gave her a second mouthful, and later a third.
"This female drinks like a cow elephant at a waterhole," Owa said sourly. "Already she has taken enough water to flood the dry riverbed of the Kwiseb."
He was right, of course, Hani conceded reluctantly. The girl had already used up a full day's adult ration. She re-plugged the ostrich egg, and though Santan pleaded and stretched out both hands appealingly, she replaced it firmly in the leather carrying satchel.
"Just a little more, please," Santan whispered.
But the old woman ignored her and turned to her companion. They argued, using their hands, graceful bird-like gestures, fluttering and flicking their fingers. The old woman wore a headband of flat white beads round her forehead and a dozen strings of the same white beads round her neck and upper arms. Around her waist was a short leather skirt, and over one shoulder a cape of spotted fur. Both garments were made from a single skin, unshaped and unstitched. The skirt was held in place by a rawhide girdle, from which were suspended a collection of tiny gourds and antelope horn containers, and she carried a long stave, the sharp end of which was weighted by a pierced stone. Santan lay and watched her avidly. She recognized intuitively that her life was under discussion, and that the old woman was her advocate.
"All that you say, revered old grandfather, is undoubtedly true. We are on a journey, and those who cannot keep up and endanger the rest must be left. That is the tradition. Yet, if we should wait that long..."
Hani pointed to a segment of the sun's transit across the sky, which was approximately an hour.
"Then this child might find enough strength, and such a short wait would put us in no danger."
Owa kept making a deep glottal sound and flicking both hands from the wrist. It was an expressive gesture that alarmed Santan.
"Our journey is an arduous one, and we still have great distances to travel. The next water is many days. To loiter here is folly."
Owa wore a crown on his head, and despite her plight, Santan found herself intrigued by it, until suddenly she realized what it was. In a beaded rawhide headband, the old man had placed 14 tiny arrows. The arrows were made of river reeds, the flights were eagle's feathers, and the heads, which were pointed skywards, were carved from white bone. Each barb was discolored by a dried paste, like freshly made coffee. And this it was that recalled to Santan the description from Levalent's book of African travels.
"Poison,"
Santan whispered. Poisoned arrows.
She shuddered and then remembered the hand-drawn illustration from the book.
They are bushmen. They are real live bushmen.
She managed to push herself upright, and both the little people looked back at her.
Already she is stronger,
Hani pointed out. But Owa began to rise.
We are on a journey, the most important journey, and the days are wasting.
Suddenly, Hani's expression altered. She was staring at Santan's body. When Santan sat up, the cotton blouse, already ragged, had caught and exposed one of her breasts. Seeing the old woman's interest, Santan realized her nudity and hastily covered herself. But now the old woman hopped close to her and leaned over her. Impatiently, she pushed Santan's hands aside, and with the surprisingly powerful fingers of her narrow, delicate-looking hands, she pressed and squeezed Santan's breasts. Santan winced and protested and tried to pull away, but the old woman was as determined and authoritative as Anna had been. She opened the torn blouse and took one of Santan's nipples between forefinger and thumb and milked it gently. A clear droplet appeared on the tip, and Hani hummed to herself and pushed Santan backwards on the sand. She put her hand up under the canvas skirt, and her little fingers prodded and probed skillfully into Santan's lower belly. At last, Hani sat back on her heels and grinned at her mate triumphantly.
"Now you cannot leave her," she gloated. "It is the strongest tradition of the people that you cannot desert a woman, any woman's son or other, who carries new life within her."
And Owar made a weary gesture of capitulation and sank down onto his haunches again. He affected an aloof air, sitting a little detached as his wife trotted down to the edge of the sea with a weighted digging stick in her hands. She inspected the wet sand carefully as the wavelets swirled around her ankles, and then she thrust the point of the stick into the sand and walked backwards, ploughing a shallow furrow. The point of the stick struck a solid object beneath the sand, and Hane darted forward, and digging with her fingers picked out something and dropped it into her carrying bag. Then she repeated the process. Within a short time she returned to where Santan lay and emptied a pile of shellfish from her bag onto the sand. They were double-shelled sand clams. Santan saw at once, and she was bitterly angry at her own stupidity. For days she had starved and thirsted as she had hobbled over a beach, alive with these luscious shellfish. The old woman used a bone-cutting tool to open one of the clams, holding it carefully so as not to spill the juices from the mother-of-pearl-lined shell, and she passed it to Santan. Ecstatically, Santan slurped the juices from the half-shell and then dug out the meat with her grubby fingers and popped it into her mouth.
"Bon," she told Hani, her whole face screwed up with exquisite pleasure as she chewed. "Très bon."
Hani grinned and bobbed her head, working on the next clam with the bone knife. It was an inefficient tool that made the opening of each shell a laborious business and broke chips of shell onto the body of the clam that gritted under Santan's teeth. After three more clams, Santan groped for her clasp knife and opened the blade. Owa had been demonstrating his disapproval by squatting a little apart and staring out to sea, but at the click of the knife blade his eyes swiveled to Santan and then widened with intense interest. The San were men of the Stone Age. But although the quarrying and smelting and working of iron were beyond their culture, Owa had seen iron implements before. He had seen those picked up by his people from the battlefields of the Black Giants, others that had been taken secretly from camps and bivouacs of strangers and travellers, and once he had known a man of the San who had possessed an implement such as this girl now held in her hand. The man's name had been Kja, the clicking sound at the back of his teeth that a horseman makes to urge on his steed. And Kja had taken Owar's eldest sister to wife 35 years before. As a young man, Ja had found the skeleton of a white man at a dry waterhole at the edge of the Kalahari. The body of the old elephant hunter had lain beside the skeleton of his horse, with his long 4-to-the-pound elephant gun at his side. Ja had not touched the gun, because he knew from legend and bitter experience that thunder lived in this strange, magical stick. But gingerly he had examined the contents of the rotting leather saddlebags and discovered such treasures as bushmen before him had only dreamed of. Firstly, there was a leather pouch of tobacco, a month's supply of it, and Ja had tucked a pinch of it under his upper lip and happily examined the rest of the hoard. Quickly he discarded a book and a roll of cardboard, which contained small balls of heavy grey metal. They were ugly and of no possible use. Then he discovered a beautiful flask of yellow metal on a leather strap. The flask was filled with useless grey powder, which he spilled into the sand, but the flask itself was so marvellously shiny that he knew no woman would be able to resist it. Ja, who was not a mighty hunter, nor a great dancer or singer, had long pined after the sister of Owa, who had a laugh that sounded like running water. He had despaired of ever catching her attention, had not even dared to shoot a miniature feather-tipped arrow from his ceremonial love-bow in her direction. But with his shiny flask in his hand, he knew that at last she would be his woman. Then Ja found the knife, and he knew that with it he would win the respect of the men of his tribe, for which he longed almost as much as he longed for the lovely sister of Owa. It was almost 30 years since Owa had last seen Ja and his sister. They had disappeared into the lonely wastes of the dry land to the east, driven from the clan by the strange emotions of envy and hatred that the knife had evoked in the other men of the tribe. Now Owa stared at a similar knife in this female's hands as she split open the clamshells and wolved raw the sweet yellow meat and drank the running juices. To this moment he had been merely repelled by the female's huge, ungainly body, bigger than any man of the San, and her enormous hands and feet, by her thick wild bush of hair and a skin which the sun had parboiled. But when he looked at the knife, all the confusing feelings of long ago flooded back, and he knew that he would lie awake at night thinking about the knife. Owa stood up. "Enough," he said to Hani. "It is time to go on."
"A little longer."
"Whether carrying a child or not, no one can endanger the lives of all. We must go on."
And again Hani knew he was right. They had already waited much longer than was wise. She stood up with him and adjusted the carrying bag on her shoulder. She saw panic flare in Santan's eyes as she realized their intention.
"Wait for me. Attendez."
Santan scrambled to her feet, terrified at the thought of being deserted. Now Owa shifted the small bow into his left hand, tucked his dangling penis back into the leather loincloth, and tightened the waistband. Then, without glancing back at the women, he started off along the edge of the beach. Hani fell in behind him. The two of them moved with a swaying jog, trot, and for the first time Santan noticed their pronounced buttocks, enormous protuberances that jutted out so sharply behind that Santan was sure she could sit astride Hani's backside and ride on it, as though on a pony's back, and the idea made her want to giggle. Hani glanced back at her and flashed an encouraging smile, and then looked ahead. Her backside bobbed and joggled, and her ancient breasts flapped against her belly. Santan took a step after them, and then came up short, stricken by dismay.
"Wrong way," she cried. "You're going the wrong way."
The two little pygmies were heading back into the north, away from Cape Town and Wolfies Bay and Luderitzbucht and all of civilization.
"You can't go that way. Come back. You can't leave me alone here. You can't."
Santan was frantic. The loneliness of the desert lay in wait for her, and like a ravening beast, it could consume her if she were left alone again. But if she followed the two little people, she was turning her back on her own kind and the succour that they might hold out for her. She took a few uncertain paces after Harney.
"Please don't go!"
The old woman understood the appeal, but she knew there was only one way to get the child moving. She did not look back.
"Please, please!"
That rhythmic jog, trot, carried the two little people away disturbingly quickly. For a few minutes longer, Son Tan hesitated, turning to look away southwards, torn and desperate. Harney was almost a quarter of a mile down the beach and showing no sign of slackening.
"Wait for me!"
Son Tan cried, and snatched up her driftwood club. She tried to run, but after 100 paces settled down to a short, hampered, but determined walk. By noon, the two figures she followed had dwindled to specks and finally disappeared into the sea fret far ahead up the beach. However, their footprints were left upon the brassy sands, tiny childlike footprints, and Son Tan fastened her whole attention upon them and never really knew how or where she found the strength to stay on her feet and live out that day. Then in the evening, when her resolve was almost gone, she lifted her eyes from the footprints, and far ahead she saw a drift of pale blue smoke wafting out to sea. It emanated from an outcrop of yellow sandstone boulders above the high water mark, and it took the last of her strength to carry her to the encampment of the San. She sank down, utterly exhausted, beside the fire of driftwood, and Harney came to her, chittering and clucking, and like a bird with its chick, fed her water from mouth to mouth. The water was warm and slimy with the old woman's saliva, but Son Tan had never tasted anything so delicious. As before, there was not enough of it, and the old woman stopped the ostrich egg shell before Son Tan's thirst was nearly slaked. Son Tan tore her gaze away from the leather carrying bag full of eggs and looked for the old man. She saw him at last. Only his head was visible as he ferreted amongst the kelp beds, out in the green waters. He had stripped naked, except for the beads around his neck and waist, and had armed himself with Harney's pointed digging stick. Son Tan watched him stiffen to point like a gun dog, and then launch a cunning thrust with the stick, and the water exploded as Owa wrestled with some large and active prey. Harney clapped her hands and ululated encouragement, and finally the old man dragged a kicking, struggling creature onto the beach. Despite her weariness and weakness, San Tan rose up on her knees and exclaimed with amazement. She knew what the quarry was. Indeed, lobster was one of her favourite dishes. But still she thought that her senses must have at last deserted her, for this creature was too big for Owa to lift. Its great armoured tail dragged in the sand, clattering as it flapped, and its long, thick whiskers reached above Owa's head as he gripped one in each of his little fists. Harney rushed down to the water's edge, armed with a rock the size of her own head, and between them they beat the huge crustacean to death. Before it was dark, Owa killed two more, each almost as large as the first, and then he and Harney scraped a shallow hole in the sand and lined it with kelp leaves. While they prepared the cooking hole, San Tan examined the three huge crustaceans. She saw immediately that they were not armed with claws like a lobster, and so must be the same species as the Mediterranean langouste that she had eaten at her uncle's table in the chateau at Lyon. But these were a mammoth variety. Their whiskers were as long as San Tan's arm, and at the root were as thick as her thumb. They were so old that barnacles and seaweed adhered to their spiny carapaces as if they were rocks. Owa and Harney buried them in a kelp-lined pit under a thin layer of sand, and then heaped a bonfire of driftwood over them. The flames lit their glowing apricot-coloured bodies as they chattered exuberantly. When their work was finished, Owa sprang up and began a shuffling little dance, singing in a cracked falsetto voice as he circled the fire. Hani clapped a rhythm for him and hummed in her throat, swaying where she sat, and Owa danced on and on while Son Tan lay exhausted and marvelled at the little man's energy and wondered vaguely at the purpose of the dance and the meaning of the words of the song.
I greet you, spirit of Red Spider from the sea, and I dedicate this dance to you, sang Owa, jerking his legs so that his naked buttocks that protruded from under the leather loincloth bounced like jellies. I offer you my dance and my respect, for you have died that we may live. And Hane punctuated the song with shrill, piping cries.
Owa, the skilled and cunning hunter, had never killed without giving thanks to the game that had fallen to his arrow or his snares, and no creature was too small and mean not to be so honoured. For being himself a small creature, he recognised the excellence of many small things, and he knew that the scaly anteater, the pangolin, was to be honoured even more than the lion, and the praying mantis, an insect, was more worthy than the elephant or the chemsbok. For in each of them reposed a special part of the godhead of nature, which he worshipped. He saw himself as no more worthy than any other of these creatures, with no rights over them other than those dictated by the survival of himself and his clan, and so he thanked the spirits of his quarry for giving him life, and when the dance ended he had beaten a pathway in the sand around the fire. He and Hani scraped away the ashes and sand and exposed the carcasses of the giant crayfish, now turned deep vermilion in colour and steaming on the bed of kelp. They burned their fingers and squealed with laughter as they broke open the scaly red tails and dug out the rich white meat. Hani beckoned to San Tan, and she squatted beside them. The legs of the crayfish contained sticks of flesh the size of her finger. The thorax was filled with the yellow livers which had been broken down in the cooking to a custard. The San used this as sauce for the flesh. San Tan could not remember ever having so much enjoyed eating. She used the knife to slice bite-sized chunks off the tail of the crayfish. Hani smiled at her in the firelight, her cheeks bulging with food, and she said, "Nam," and then again, "Nam." San Tan listened carefully, then repeated it with the same inflection as the old woman had used. "Nam!" And Hani squealed gleefully. "Did you hear, Owa? The child said, 'Good.'" Owa grunted and watched the knife in the female's hand. He found he could not take his eyes off it. The blade sliced through the meat so cleanly that it left a sheen on it. "How sharp it must be," thought Owa, and the sharpness of the blade spoiled his appetite. With a stomach so full that it was almost painful, San Tan lay down beside the fire, and Hani came to her and scraped out a hollow for her hip in the sand beneath her. It was immediately more comfortable, and she settled down again, but Hani was trying to show her something else.
"You must not lay your head on the ground, Nam child," she explained. "You must keep it up like this."
Hani propped herself on one elbow and then laid her head on her own shoulder. It looked awkward and uncomfortable, and San Tan smiled her thanks, but lay flat.
"Leave her," grunted Owa. "When a scorpion crawls into her ear during the night, she will understand."
"She has learned enough for one day," Hani agreed. "Did you hear her say Nam? That is her first word, and that is the name I will give her, Nam." She repeated it. "Nam child."
Owa grunted and went off into the darkness to relieve himself. He understood his wife's unnatural interest in the stranger and the child she carried in her womb. But there was a fearful journey ahead, and the woman
would be a dangerous nuisance. Then, of course, there was the knife. Thinking about the knife made him angry.